All right, guys, there's something that has always captured my attention and humbled me here in Mark chapter 14 regarding Jesus and this ridiculous trial that they put him through in the middle of the night. And so I'm going to read this. It starts in verse 53, Mark 14, kind of a long section. And go ahead and read along with me, Mark 14, starting in verse 53. It says, they led Jesus to the high priest. This is after everybody runs away and the naked young man runs away and everything else. They led Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests and the elders of the scribes came together. And Peter had followed at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. And he was sitting with the guards and warming himself at the fire. Now the chief priests and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death. But they found none. And many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. Some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy the temple and make it with hands, and that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another, not made with hands. And yet even about this, their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you? But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven. And the high priest tore his garments and said, what further witnesses do we need? You have heard this blasphemy. What is your decision? And they all condemned him as deserving death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and strike him, saying, prophesy. And the guards received him with blows. So that's the evil midnight court hearing, or whatever you want to call it. Not much of a hearing if they don't listen to him. That's what hearing means. But there's several things that are shocking in here. First of all, this is a religious court. High priests, scribes, elders of the people, all this stuff. These are the guys that are supposed to know how justice works. Read your Old Testament. Read your Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. Pay attention to how you're supposed to go about investigating criminal behavior. You need two witnesses. The two witnesses need to agree. Again, just two witnesses that say separate things are not two witnesses. They're two separate witnesses. They need to agree together. The thing they're describing needs to be legitimate and not obviously falsified and made up. Two witnesses to agree together. These guys can't, okay? Many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. Get 1,000 people to make up 1,000 different things. None of that doesn't make two. That makes 1,000 separate things. You need two witnesses that agree together, according to Old Testament law, to have a case. And these priests certainly knew that. They knew their Bibles really well. They certainly knew this stuff. All right, there's all sorts of things that they're breaking by doing this in the middle of the night, by bringing in false witnesses. Of course, don't bear false witness is one of the Ten Commandments. And not only is that one of the Ten Commandments, but it's obvious that these guys are bearing false witness. It's obvious to the witnesses who are there. Their testimony did not agree. It's obvious when the testimonies don't agree. You can tell. You listen to them and you say, hey, that doesn't sound right. They're saying, oh, I'll destroy the temple in 3 days and build another. Yet even in this, their testimony did not agree. The priest at this point, anybody, priest or otherwise, you don't even have to be an Old Testament scholar. You could be a total Gentile and have never heard of a Bible. And it's common sense would tell you, these guys are making this up. They're just mad at him. They're obviously just accusing him falsely. That's the clear indication of this. That not only was it all false, but that it was obviously false. And people who were there could tell it was false. So if you care about justice at all, you slam the gavel down or whatever your court system has, and you say, case dismissed, this is a joke. And you might yell at the prosecutors in this, why did you even bring this here? You didn't have any argument. You're doing it wrong. anybody with a lick of righteousness and justice would dismiss this situation. a good religious person ought to all the more. They ought to know and care about justice more than just an average guy. But these guys care about it less. And instead of dismissing it, look at what he does. Verse 60. The high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, "Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?" He's asking Jesus what the witnesses are saying against him. What is this that they're saying against you? He's demanding Jesus own up to and explain the false witnesses that have come against him. It's like a, "Hey, when did you stop beating your wife?" kind of question. You ever hear that? Any answer you give incriminates you. "When did you stop beating your wife?" I never did. And you automatically sound defensive. Whatever. Like, I never stopped. What, you never stopped beating her? No, I never started beating her. Like, no matter how you answer that question, you look like the bad guy. Jesus doesn't even answer because there's no answer. Like, the system is unjust. They have accused him falsely and unjustly. And so the right thing to do in a situation is to not even answer. And that in itself is one of the most humbling things for me personally to read, because I don't know about you, and I'll admit this is about me, and I believe it probably applies to other people as far as application goes. When people accuse me of something, true, false, or half true, I get really defensive. Like, defensiveness just boils up within me on the spot. If they strike a nerve that it's actually true, I get defensive. If it's false, I get defensive. If it's half true, I get defensive. It's a thing that I know about myself. I'm not saying that that's a good thing. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. It's mostly a bad thing. but, you know, you want to defend yourself, especially when it's untrue, or especially the parts of it that are untrue. You really don't. I don't want you saying false things about me. Who would? And it's right to stand up for the innocent. And if you're the innocent, it's right to stand up for yourself. Right? I mean, to a degree, obviously, not just pound your chest and stomp your feet and demand my rights or whatever just because I'm selfish. But it's not wrong to be defensive of yourself when you are falsely being accused. And Jesus has the total self-control to not even answer them. Just as he had the self-control in the garden that same night to not call down 12 legions of angels to come and wipe out all the bad guys, he had the self-control to heal the guy's ear that Peter had cut off and to tell Peter to put that thing away and stop acting like this, Peter. A good guy. Peter's not perfect, but Peter's a good guy. Peter's on Jesus' team. And Jesus had to stop his own guy from defending him in order to go with bad guys who are going to crucify him. Jesus had to have all this self-control. And then he had to sit here and listen to these false witnesses. Can you imagine God himself on trial, having to put up with people bearing false witness against him? And then some priest who's supposed to go between God and man, going against God and saying, "Do you have any explanation for yourself? How do you explain all this bad stuff they're saying?" Can you imagine that? This is why Jesus was praying all night really hard that you not enter into temptation, because he's going to be really tempted to rise up in his flesh. And his prayer was, "Not my will, but yours." His prayer was, "Not me, not my flesh." He didn't even trust himself, and he's Jesus. Didn't even trust himself because he knew they're going to put me in positions where I'm going to want to stand up and defend myself. And I'm supposed to carry a cross up a hill to die. And if I start rising up to pretend to defend myself, then I will not carry out this humbling mission God has sent me on, and I will fail. And so he is praying, "God, Father, you do this. You rise up in me. You make this happen, because I'm going to be tempted to join with Peter and start pulling swords out. I'm going to be tempted to shout down at the courthouse and tell them what for. I'm going to be tempted to not carry this cross up that hill and to smite them and put them on the cross or whatever. going to be tempted to do all those things. They're spitting on him later. They're mocking him, ripping out his beard, calling him names. Can you imagine that? Without even getting defensive, without being without caring about himself. Now, when they ask him this question, they say, "Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?" This is a question he can answer truthfully without playing their game. If he tries to defend himself against the false witnesses, he's now enmeshed in their game. And you have holy God playing games with dirty, profane people. And God is holy, and he stands apart from that, and he does not even say a word to it. He stands apart. But when they ask him a direct question, who are you? You know, are you the Christ, Son of the Blessed? Now, they're obviously asking this to trap him, because if he says yes, they're going to accuse him of blasphemy. And if he says no, who knows what else they'll say, but he would be lying, and they would either kill him anyway because they hated him that much, or they would set him back free and say, "Hey, look, everybody, he says he's not." So he says yes. He answers the question, and he answers the question truthfully, and he answers the question not only truthfully but with a really potent warning. I am. That answers the question. Yes, I am. And you are going to see it coming on the clouds of heaven. All right, one last warning. You want to stop with your false witness stuff, with your middle of the night evil? You want to stop? You're going to see me coming on the clouds of heaven. You better stop now. That's the subtext. But no, they don't listen. Instead, they say, what further witnesses do we need? You heard his blasphemy. So no matter what he says here, they're going to get him. And so he speaks the truth. And they use the truth, the fact that he spoke the truth, they're going to accuse him, therefore, of blasphemy, and they're going to hang him on a cross. Spit on him and cover his face and strike him, saying, "Prophesy." And the guards received him with blows. It's shocking. It's absolutely shocking that he would tolerate this, that God himself would tolerate this. Would you tolerate it? Like, man, I don't know where I'd be. I'm not pretending that I'm some sort of fighter and tough guy. Like, I'm not saying that. But I would really want to fight back, even if I'm just a little kind of a pansy and not really very good at fighting. I would not just tolerate this stuff. Not in my flesh. I would rage. I think most people would, or cower in fear and despair, and "Oh, please don't hurt me," and hide and fetal position kind of stuff, whatever. Other you might be tempted to go that way. I don't know. Jesus just takes it, and he's God. If anybody has a right to rise up and stop this evil, it's God. But Jesus is submitted to God. He is God, and he is submitted to the Father. And he is on a mission to be merciful to his creation. And so if he rises up in judgment against his creation, then he is no longer showing mercy. And there is a time and place, and God is slow to anger, but it doesn't mean that he is never angry. And there will be a time when he comes back. And we know this. But in this moment, he is here for mercy, and he stands by, and he allows them to judge God because he is slow to anger and he is merciful. And it is amazing to me. And when I read that love is patient in Philippians, or 1 Corinthians 13, when I read the fruit of the Spirit in Galatians 5, self-control, patience. Man, that's what I—that's what Christ. That's who he was. That's what he did. That's this little passage here, continuing with the trial with Pilate and everybody else, and the crucifixion. All of this is proof of just exactly what love means. Love is patient. Love is kind. 1 Corinthians 13. and the fruit of the Spirit. If those are all really high and lofty ideals and human goals and whatever, but the Bible isn't just about telling you what love looks like and what the fruit of the Spirit looks like. The Bible is true. And right here is some proof that it is true. If God could submit himself to this stuff, and God lives in you, then you can too. And if God lives in me and somebody wants to accuse me falsely, sometimes happens to all of us, right? But God lives in me, I can be patient. You can be patient because we have Christ. All right? That's what I get from this. It's shocking just how patient he is. Absolutely shocking. And this isn't even the worst of it. They're going to nail him to the cross before long, by the next day. Pilate, this Roman bad guy, is going to go up there and pretend that he is in judgment of God. And Jesus patiently shows mercy here. It's absolutely incredible. Mind-boggling. God is good. He's infinitely good. He's infinitely better than us. He lives in us. It's very humbling. God bless you. We'll look farther into this tomorrow. I'll see you then.